Germany, Jordan, Norway, Turkey. All these forces were alongside us because they shared the values, the sense that terrorism was a threat to everyone. So when you go into these kind of situations, you need every ally you can get your hands on. You need all of them. You need their votes in the United Nations. You need their troops on the ground. This is an international effort, and I think throughout history we see nations with allies thrive and nations without allies wither.
Now, you have said you don't want to criticize a sitting president. We should say that you rarely mention the president by name in this book, but you do publish the letter of resignation, and you also write this. These are your words, General. A polemicist's role is not sufficient for a leader, and returning to a strategic stance that includes the interests of as many nations as we can make common cause with, we can better deal with this imperfect world. The words on the page suggest to me that you do criticize the president.
Yeah, again, Steve, I started writing the book in 2013, and we were on version 5, my co-author and I, Bing West, in 2017, thinking the book was pretty much done.
Mm-hmm.
I had never taken part in a political campaign. I'd never met Mr. Trump. And so, you know, I'm saying what I stand for, what I learned over all these years. I want to pass on those lessons in a way that allows young people to learn. And you'll notice that I have seen challenges and problems with our strategy that go further back than any one president that's in office today.
I do want to ask about your strategic sense, particularly in the region that you knew best. What is wrong with the U.S. long-term approach to that region?
Well, it's the most complex security issues that I think I've dealt with. They're all caught up in that region right now. It's not that there is something inherently wrong. It's whether or not we've clarified our policy in our own minds, and are we able to carry it out in a strategically sound manner. For example, I think it was Einstein who said, if given an hour to save the world, how would he compose his thinking? He said, well, I'd take 55 minutes to define the problem, and then I'd save the world in 5 minutes.
Hmm.
I think we need to do a better job of ordering the problems, disciplining the problems, and defining them in a way that we get agreement on what is the problem we're trying to solve.
Is this a fair summary of your disagreement with U.S. political leaders in both Afghanistan and Iraq? In each case, you have seen a long-term problem that calls for a long-term commitment, a troop commitment somewhat like the U.S. has had in South Korea, say, and you've had political leaders who want to get in and get out.
Well, the problem we face is when you get into a war. We were attacked on 9/11, for example. And what you have got to do is figure out what it is you intend to do at the outset and then hold firm to that. And I think that we have had serious policy challenges in figuring out exactly what it is we intend to do and then holding firm to that vision.
You describe disagreeing specifically with then Vice President Joe Biden over the U.S. withdrawal of troops from Iraq in 2011 and say that you expected that the U.S. would have to be drawn back in.
Well, that wasn't my assessment alone. The intelligence community came in. I was briefed, and I still remember one of the young ladies briefing me from the intelligence community, and she outright guaranteed me that if we withdrew all of our troops at the time and on the timeline that was being discussed, we would have to go back in because the enemy would surge and they would become a threat to us again. And that, unfortunately, is exactly what happened.
I guess we should describe Vice President Biden had a difference of opinion with you about the value of the then Iraqi prime minister and whether he would be supportive of a continued U.S. troop presence. Did Vice President Biden misread the situation in some way?
You know, all leaders have got to be able to build trust. I did not believe that the Iraqi prime minister was a man who could build trust. And if you can't do that, especially under the stresses that Iraq was going through, it was virtually in a post-combat but pre-reconciliation phase. And we're not always going to be blessed to have a Mandela man type person. Mandela brought South Africa back together. You're not always going to have that sort of leader. But I felt the man who was in that we were backing at that time was especially deficient in trust-building ability.
There is one question of fact that I want to ask you about President Trump. You want to have a long-term vision. You want to think long-term. In your experience, did the President of the United States have a long-term strategic sense in the areas that you knew best?
Well, Steve, I'm going to frustrate you on this. I don't discuss sitting presidents in terms of making political assessments. National defense is a nonpartisan issue, and I want to keep the Department of Defense in a nonpartisan mode.
Yeah, and that's why I understand that and respect that, and so I'm not even asking you, is this a good president or a bad president? I'd just like to know, in your interactions, does this president think long-term?
The long-term nature of what we do is carried out not just by the president, also by especially the Secretary of State. And no doubt the president's Secretary of State does think long-term. And by the Secretary of Defense and our military-to-military relationships and are in many cases very, very strong today, even stronger with some nations today than they were 2 or 4 years ago.
Your answer then is that the people around the president are thinking long term. Is that what you're telling me, General?
Well, the president has hired people to do this very job, yes.
Jim Mattis spent decades in the U.S. Marines, fought in both Afghanistan and Iraq, and served as President Trump's Secretary of Defense until his resignation. His book is called Call Sign Chaos, and tomorrow we hear how Mattis organized his role in the war in Iraq, what the U.S. planned for and didn't.
In Odessa, Texas, people are trying to make sense of a man taking to their streets and randomly shooting people on Saturday afternoon. 36-year-old Seth Aaron Attar started firing after a failed traffic stop. He took off through the West Texas city, killing at least 7 people, injuring 22 more before police finally killed him. Marfa Public Radio's Mitch Borden went to a vigil where hundreds of people came to mourn and to try to move forward.
Standing together at a local college campus, Odessans gathered to support each other and remember the fallen. I was lost. It was only a day since the shooting, and local school bus driver Olga Jacobo is scared to leave her house.
I'm looking at everybody now. I'm just scared for everybody and of everybody.
But Jacobo did come out because she wanted to be with her community. Like Jacobo, Carolyn Ransom said she didn't think this could ever happen in a place like this.
I can't believe this. You know, I travel that street all the time. I know the area that the shooter was going. I'm always around in that area.
At the vigil, Odessa's Mayor David Turner told the gathering crowd that they can get through these tragic times.
Yesterday was a horrible day that shook us to our very foundation. But this will not break us. In West Texas, you have to be tough.
Among the wounded were 3 police officers and a 17-month-old baby girl. The youngest killed was a 15-year-old high school student. Jerry Morales, the mayor of the neighboring city, Midland, said the two communities need to come together during this ordeal.
We're going to talk about healing. We're going to talk about love. We're going to talk about coming together as one. And we're going to continue praying.
People have faith Odessa will heal. Marcos Olivias spent yesterday afternoon laying on his floor trying to stay safe while the shooting took place. Today, he is holding a candle and standing up for his community.
We have to come out. We can't stay in hiding, you know? So we're here. That's all we can do is just keep going.
After singing and praying together, the night ended with people talking, hugging, and comforting one another as they filtered back to their cars. For NPR News, I'm Mitch Borden in Odessa.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio, and thanks for joining us today. Coming up, we'll have the latest on Hurricane Dorian, which has been pounding the northern Bahamas. It's one of the strongest storms ever recorded and is making its way to the U.S. That update in about 17 minutes here on WPR.
Since our inception in 1917 with the experimental broadcast license 9XM, Wisconsin Public Radio has been committed to strong, independent, and meaningful public radio in Wisconsin. Now in our second century of operation, WPR continues to serve the state of Wisconsin, thanks in part to the generous contributions of our 9XM Leadership Circle members, who give $1,200 a year or more. We invite you to join the 9XM Leadership Circle at wpr.org/donate.
Support for WPR comes from the EVU Foundation, the charitable arm of the Cap Times, whose Idea Fest is on campus September 13th and 14th. Information and tickets are at captimesideafest.com.
Support comes from the App Factory at UW Parkside. Is your business or nonprofit in need of a mobile app? Student interns at the App Factory make state-of-the-art and user-friendly apps for phones and other mobile devices. Web applications, too. For more information, visit appfactory.uwp.edu.
Some patchy morning fog and then partly sunny skies today, breezy in the north, and we might see thunderstorms in the evening hours across the state. Highs from the upper 70s to the low 80s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Westin Hotels and Resorts, offering a range of wellness options for guests, including their Eat Well menu, on-demand fitness gear lending program, and signature heavenly bed. Learn more at Westin.com, a member of Marriott Bonvoy. From the Kauffman Foundation, working together with communities in education and entrepreneurship to create uncommon solutions and empower people to shape their lives and be more successful. More online at Kauffman.org. And from Jones Day, an integrated partnership collaboratively providing legal services for more than a century, 43 offices, 5 continents, serving clients as one firm worldwide. Learn more at JonesDay.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. It is now September, which means more U.S. tariffs on Chinese products have taken effect. The 15% charge hits consumer goods like tools and clothes and shoes and electronics, which means the tariffs are moving closer and closer to the core business of Apple. President Trump may have urged U.S. businesses to get out of China, but reporter Stephen Nellis of Reuters says that is not so easy for Apple.
It's kind of married to China in as much as Apple is big, it's one of the biggest, and China is big, it's one of the biggest.
Nellis covers Apple, as for a long time, and says the company has found ways to avoid many tariffs up to now. But getting out of China entirely? That's not very likely because Apple makes so many phones in China that are shipped to the United States.
So when you're making 200 million plus devices a year and you want to have them move very quickly through that supply chain, it's hard to find it anywhere else but China. So one of the things that Tim Cook, who's the current CEO of Apple, is famous for is he built out this supply chain where Apple could make tremendous numbers of devices but only hold a few days of inventory at a time. So 200 million devices per year, any given time, Apple only has maybe 5 days worth of inventory on hand. That's what's made the company so tremendously profitable because inventory that's sitting around costs money to a company. So unless Apple wanted to sacrifice that profitability, it'd be difficult to move anywhere else but China.
Wow, the just-in-time delivery on that scale and on a global scale is about as breathtaking as anything I've heard about Apple.
That's right. And you know, you probably have seen some stories that other companies are looking at moving manufacturing to places like Vietnam. And I think it's important to keep in mind with Apple that most other companies are shipping not nearly as many phones as they are. So they have a lot more flexibility in being able to move their supply chain.
How has Apple largely avoided tariffs up to now in the trade war?
One way that it's done so is simply by asking the government not to impose a tariff. So some Apple products like the AirPods wireless earbuds or the Apple Watch were actually set to be tariffed almost a year ago now. And the company, along with many other electronics manufacturers, sent a comment letter to the government and said, please don't do this. And also you've seen CEO Tim Cook go have dinner with President Trump and try to impress upon him what these tariffs will mean to companies like Apple.
Isn't China also a market as well as a supplier for Apple? They sell a lot of iPhones in China.
Absolutely. So the Greater China region, which includes mainland China and a few other places like Hong Kong and Macau, it accounts for more than a fifth of Apple's revenue. The primary way the trade war has actually hurt Apple so far has not been through tariffs, but the impact of the trade war on the Chinese economy. So the trade restrictions that the U.S. has imposed have slowed economic growth, and that in turn has made it very difficult for Apple to sell its phones in China.
We are in a situation where the Trump administration keeps adding or threatening more tariffs on products from China. What is happening to Apple now that we're into September?
Well, most analysts are expecting Apple to essentially absorb these tariffs. Passing the cost on to consumers would raise prices for Apple products, which are already priced at a premium, and that would simply result in Apple selling fewer products, so they'll probably absorb it, and then there are multiple levers they can try to pull to essentially avoid them.
If Apple eats the cost of the tariffs to some extent, does the stock price go down? Do the dividends get smaller? What happens?
So Apple's investors will largely eat this because Apple's profits will dip and the stock is valued on the basis of those profits.
And if the president goes through with even more tariffs on December 15, is Apple finally going to get to the point where they cannot avoid massive tariff penalties?
December 15th is the big day for Apple because that's the day where the iPhone would be hit. Unless they make some kind of parcel solution like making the circuit boards for iPhones in a separate country and putting those circuit boards in the ones bound for America. But even that is bound to incur significant amounts of cost for Apple because the supply chain is just so highly efficient and has been smoothed out over a decade now.
Stephen Nellis of Reuters, thanks very much for your insights.
Thank you for having me.
She possesses superhuman speed and strength. She can recover from almost any injury. She can change the size and shape of her body. She's Kamala Khan, also known as Ms. Marvel, a superhero. And Kevin Feige, president of Marvel Studios, says she's making big career moves.
Ms. Marvel, Kamala Khan, Muslim Pakistani teenager from Jersey City, is coming to the MCU. It is remarkably exciting for us. You will meet her in her Disney Plus series, and then you will see her in our films.
Okay, for the uninitiated, the MCU is the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Khan was the first Muslim Marvel character to headline her own comic book 5 years ago, and now she will be the first Muslim superhero to get her own live-action television show on Disney's new streaming service.
I think all of us on Team Ms. Marvel are so excited for what is happening next with this character. I still pinch myself.
That's Ms. Marvel's co-creator G. Willow Wilson, who is herself a convert to Islam. She says comic book readers are more diverse than ever.
I think it's important for comic book readers of all backgrounds to be able to see some story that they can relate to on a really visceral level. Yes, that's me. That's my life.
Ms. Marvel's costume was inspired by Pakistani dress, expanding the expectations of a superhero story.
You have to think about what stories have we not told yet? Are we retreading something that we've already said a million times? Or are we pushing ourselves to come up with something new?
Now, there is not an official release date for the show yet, but Wilson says she cannot wait to see how her character will evolve.
I've kind of stepped back as a writer, and now I get to see the next part of her history unfold, and I get to do that as a fan.
As do so many others. We're glad you joined us on Morning Edition on this holiday Monday morning. Remember that you can follow All Things Considered this afternoon for the latest news. You can also find us on social media. On Twitter, we are at Noel King, NPR Green, Rachel NPR, and my handle there is NPR Inski. This is NPR News.
It took rapper Common a while to come around to the idea of talking to a professional about his problems.
When you knew somebody was going to a therapist, you looked at them like, man, something is really wrong with you. Not knowing it, it was something wrong with me too.
Common on Therapy, Relationships, and his new album, Let Love, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in for All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Morning Edition here on WPR. Up next, it's news from NPR. And in Wisconsin news, amid increasing concerns about vaping, one school district in the state let students avoid citations for e-cigarette use if they take a class about its dangers. We'll hear more in just a minute.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Mandatory evacuations begin at midday in coastal areas of Georgia and South Carolina because of Hurricane Dorian. More than 1.3 million people east of Interstate 95 are being told to get out. That includes the cities of Savannah and Charleston. Mandatory and voluntary evacuations are underway along Florida's east coast. Dorian remains a dangerous Category 5 hurricane with top sustained winds of 165 miles per hour. It's nearly stalled over Grand Bahama Island in the northwest Bahamas this morning. CNN reporter Patrick Oppmann is in Freeport on Grand Bahama. He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition.
You have a strong Category 5 that is essentially stalled out over us. And that means it'll be hours, if not days, of just getting a complete beating. And that also raises the possibility of a very high storm surge. And they've been talking about a storm surge of 20 feet, which sounds terrifying. Then you add the fact that we're on an island where the highest point of land is 30 feet.
The International Red Cross says thousands of homes have been damaged or destroyed on Grand Bahama and the Abaco Islands. Cars are flipped and trees and power lines are down. National Hurricane Center in Miami says Dorian will likely move close to Florida before turning to the north. There's no trading today on Wall Street because of the Labor Day holiday. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. A public hearing in Rhinelander sought to ask why the North Woods is losing freight rail capacity with hopes of reversing that trend. The hearing was organized by Senator Tom Tiffany and a Michigan lawmaker. Rob Menser has more.
In almost all parts of Wisconsin, businesses in recent years have seen expanded access to freight trains. In a cluster of Northwoods counties bordering Michigan's Upper Peninsula, rail service has declined. That means logging companies and other manufacturers must rely on trucks to move their goods, and that in turn means more damage to Wisconsin's rural roads. Larry Lloyd is a spokesman for the CN Railroad. He said at the hearing that it's simply a question of demand.
Railroads are always hesitant to make investments for demand that could possibly happen down the road. It's got to be a level where we can anticipate there being consistent long-term demand.
Advocates say the rail companies ought to be more willing to invest. They say service line closures hurt northern Wisconsin's economy. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Students caught using e-cigarettes in Eau Claire Public Schools will avoid fines if they agree to take a class on the dangers of vaping. Rather than paying a $50 fine, students will be able to sign up for a court diversion program called Catch My Breath. It teaches students about health hazards from e-cigarettes and offers tips on how to say no to peer pressure. Dan Rossmiller of the Wisconsin Association of School Boards calls it a unique approach to a growing problem.
The Eau Claire approach is an interesting one because it seems to take a public health approach, trying to educate students about the health effects of vaping, much of the long-term effects of which are not well understood.
State lawmakers are also addressing increased e-cigarette use among kids. A bipartisan bill has been introduced to raise the smoking and vaping age from 18 to 21. Milwaukee police say a 46-year-old woman was fatally shot after confronting a driver following a minor crash on the city's north side. The Journal Sentinel reports the woman was a passenger in the vehicle that got struck about 5:15 p.m. Friday. Police say she got out of the vehicle and exchanged words with the driver, who pulled out a gun, shot her, and then fled. Police are searching for the shooter. No other details about the shooting were released. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Campaign Monitor, an email marketing platform with a drag-and-drop email builder and mobile-ready templates used by more than 250,000 customers at campaignmonitor.com. Campaign Monitor, make your emails unforgettable. And from Elsevier, a global information analytics business serving scientists and clinicians, with a commitment to helping them to manage their work more efficiently so they can spend more time making breakthroughs. Elsevier.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Hurricane Dorian is right now battering the Bahamas with high winds and torrential rains. Next, it is expected to turn oh so slowly north and west. As it moves along its path, Dorian is expected to graze the coastlines of Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas. And the fact that it is moving so slowly, that in and of itself poses a particular kind of threat. Joel Klein is a meteorologist at the National Hurricane Center in Miami, Florida, and he joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Why has it been so hard to forecast the path of this particular storm?
Well, it's just been, from the beginning, a small storm when it started out in the Atlantic. And, you know, you're looking at global models to predict a small storm. Then as it got bigger as a hurricane, then the steering flow got to be quite lax. And so now it's stalled out. But still, you know, we have managed to forecast well enough to evacuate areas that need to be evacuated and hopefully make people aware quite well in advance.
Right. So it looks at this point like southernmost Florida might be safe from all this. At this point, who is not safe?
Well, a lot of people that are living on the Florida East Coast, mainly is who we're worried about. We have watches and warnings up of various kinds from essentially the Brevard-Volusia County line here in Florida all the way up to the Georgia line. And then if you live on the coast and in Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina up through Cape Hatteras, as the days go on through the week through Thursday, Friday morning, before it gets up to North Carolina's coast and out to sea, then all those people who have property and interest in those areas should pay very, very close attention to this dangerous storm.
It's going to be a long week. Can we talk about the speed of this? I mentioned how slowly it's moving. Why?
Right.
Why is it that way?
So when it was starting to move, as you recall, last week when it was down in Dominica and coming through the Leeward Islands and then went up east of Puerto Rico, we had a strong ridge pushing it up toward the area that it's at right
now.
A
ridge of what? What does that mean when you say a strong ridge?
High pressure system.
Okay.
So I used to have a boss down here that related it to like the hurricanes of Cork, and it's in a stream or a river, right? And so the stream is all the upper air patterns, be it a ridge or a trough,
okay,
or an area of low pressure. And so that cork maintains itself and goes through the stream. So the ridge had been very, very strong and pushing that up pretty good rate of speed up toward the Bahamas. And then that has eroded. It's gotten less of a ridge. Right, it's retreated back toward the Bermuda.
Mm-hmm.
Always hear of the Bermuda High. Well, now it's just waiting on the next thing to pick it up in the stream and move it along. So just pretend like that cork's going over to the shore in an area where it's not in the water. And so now it's waiting on the next thing to pick it up, which will be a trough, and then it'll start to move, we hope, in the northerly traction here and forecast in the next little bit.
So we're in the strange situation of wanting it to move where it could do damage in other places, but the longer it sits over a particular location, the more damage it does there.
Catastrophic for the Bahamas.
Yeah, Joel Klein, meteorologist at the National Hurricane Center in Miami. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah, bye-bye.
Indonesia is cracking down on a movement in the far eastern part of that country. More than 1,000 soldiers and police have deployed to the Papuan region to quell protests. Dozens have been arrested, and at least one soldier and two demonstrators are dead since the demonstrations turned violent more than a week ago. The government has also shut down the internet in that region in an effort to stop the spread of what it calls fake news. Here's NPR's Ashley Westerman.
The Indonesian government first slowed the internet. Then, on August 21st, it blocked all cellular and cable internet in Papua and West Papua provinces. It was a response to demonstrations sparked by videos of Papuan students in another part of the country being racially insulted by Indonesian nationalist groups. Since the unrest began, demonstrators have torched buildings and clashed with police. This video from Twitter shows protesters in West Papua marching and singing separatist songs. Victor Yemo is spokesperson for the pro-Papuan independence movement.
This is the first time the Indonesian block the internet in whole West Papua.
Speaking on a landline from an area where the internet's out, Yemo says these protests are Papuan's response to 50 years of racism by people he calls outsiders.
People are very angry about this situation. What they are thinking today is they need to be free from Indonesia colonialism.
Indonesian colonialism. That's what many indigenous Papuans say they have been fighting since the 60s when the Dutch relinquished the territory to Indonesia.
There was a what many would consider a sham referendum in 1969.
Greg Poling is with the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies.
And ever since then, there has been demands that the Papuan people be given the chance to really vote for their status. So these protests are part of a regular cycle, although these are the largest and most sustained we've seen in some years.
Over the decades, global human rights groups have documented alleged violations by state security forces stationed in the region, one of Indonesia's poorest. The abuses range from censorship to rape and torture. Human rights lawyer Veronica Coleman says the internet shutdown is alarming because it makes it hard to monitor for abuses.
And given the track record of the state security forces against West Papuan people, this is a very emergency situation.
Jakarta continues to defend its decision to shut down the internet while calling for calm in the region. They won't say when the block will be lifted. Still, photos and videos of demonstrations are getting through. Like this one, which shows men, women, and children marching in the streets, waving flags, and chanting pro-independence slogans. Ashley Westerman, NPR News.
Later today on All Things Considered, we'll hear from one of Jeffrey Epstein's accusers, one of many women who says the financier recruited and sexually abused her. To listen to that story, ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition here on WPR. And later this hour, the Hulu documentary about movie mogul Harvey Weinstein weaves together eyewitness accounts, the work of investigative journalists, and the voices of women who have accused him of assault and harassment. We'll have a review from Eric Deggans in about 12 minutes here on WPR.
A lot of stunt actors don't feel they're getting the recognition they deserve, even when stunts are everywhere.
More and more, Hollywood is reliant on big action films or, you know, space fantasies, adventures, things like that. And very often, these films require stunts.
I'm Kai Rizdal. The fight for a Best Stunt Oscar next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Bernie's Rock Shop, a family-owned business on East Johnson in Madison, featuring a variety of colored stone jewelry, along with mineral and fossil specimens from around the world. Bernie's Rock Shop is proud to support WPR.
Support for WGTD comes from Hupie and Abraham. Year after year, Hupie and Abraham is voted and rated best personal injury law firm. If you're injured, call the firm that has collected over $1 billion for its clients. 800-800-5678 or hupie.com.
It's 8:44 now. I'm Melissa Ingalls, and here are some of the stories we're following today. Yemen is reeling from what's been described as the deadliest attack so far this year. Multiple airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition hit a detention center run by the country's Houthi rebels, killing at least 100 people and wounding dozens. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says Iran will go back to complying with its 2015 nuclear deal with world powers in full only when European nations go back to delivering on their commitments. Zarif made the remarks in Moscow while his deputy traveled to Paris in a renewed diplomatic push to renew the nuclear deal that President Donald Trump withdrew America from over a year ago. And a new report from the University of Wisconsin-Madison finds agriculture and food processing making up a growing part of the state's economy. We'll have all the latest news from NPR and WPR coming up in 15 minutes. Stay tuned.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, with its skills tests built for employers who want to see a deeper sense of the person behind the resume. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Apple Music, now with Sam Fender's song, The Borders, on the New Music Daily playlist, a curated playlist that refreshes daily and allows people to follow current artists. Now on Apple Music. And from the William T. Grant Foundation at WTGrantFoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Fires are still burning across the world's largest rainforest. Some studies show they could trigger what scientists call a death spiral that could turn the Amazon into a dry savanna. What would that mean for Earth's oxygen levels? Science writer Peter Brannon wrote about this for The Atlantic magazine, and he talked with our co-host David Green.
A lot of people have been tossing around this concept that the Amazon really is the lungs of the planet. You seem to suggest that is just not the case.
Well, yeah. So deforestation in the Amazon is something we should all be worried about. It's a huge carbon sink. It's got just immeasurable biodiversity, and there's indigenous tribes there crowded out by ranchers and people who are burning down their home. Mm-hmm. And so there's all these reasons to be concerned about the Amazon. And there is a little bit of confusion, though, about this, whether it is provides the planet with its oxygen, or there's this number thrown around, 20% or maybe it's 6%.
I've seen that a lot. Yeah, 20% of the world's oxygen supply comes from the Amazon. Is that not
right.
the case?
Yeah, I mean, that's a little confused from sort of a bigger picture of where our oxygen comes from. You know, it's encouraging that it is not a major threat if we, you know, burn every forest down in the world. Obviously, we don't want to do that.
Right.
But the reason is actually kind of unsettling as well. And it has to do with the formation of fossil fuels, of all things, is why we ended up with the amount of oxygen we have in the air. And the fact that we're digging up and burning fossil fuels is actually dropping oxygen faster than, you know, burning down the forests on the surface of the planet.
Digging up fossil fuels is more dangerous potentially to our oxygen supply than forest burning.
Luckily, we have so much oxygen in the atmosphere that we basically couldn't make a dent in it at all. Now, the reason for this is that when a plant dies or a bloom of plankton dies, if it somehow gets buried and that oxygen never gets used up, over geological time, you can build up a reservoir of oxygen in the air like we have today. So we really have all of Earth history to thank for every breath we take.
Can I just ask you about one thing our listeners heard? We had a reporter from the region in Brazil, and I was asking him about this 20% number, and he said if you destroy more rainforest, it starts to dry out, and
yes,
it absorbs less carbon dioxide, and that could be a real bad situation for climate change. Is that accurate?
That's a huge problem, and it's something to be incredibly concerned about. So far, I think 17% of the Amazon has been deforested by humanity, essentially, and there might be a threshold around 20 to 25%. This was reported by James Temple in the MIT Technology Review that if you get to that point, there might be this feedback loop where it starts drying out and then it no longer becomes a carbon sink like it is today, but it eventually could put up lots of carbon dioxide into the air and virtually make meeting the Paris Climate Agreement goals impossible. Like, this is one of the many reasons we should be very concerned about the rainforest.
It's not just fires in the Amazon. We're seeing this in different spots around the world, Alaska, Indonesia, Siberia. I mean, what does this tell us in terms of the battle against climate change?
I mean, it's predicted by, you know, every model that we're going to have more drought. There's going to be more wildfires around the world. The really strange thing, which I write about in my story, is that not only are we burning down trees on the surface of the planet, but we're essentially, as a species, trying to dig up all the forests ever in Earth history. So this is things like coal and oil and natural gas. So we're trying to dig up all the life ever. And we could burn down way more organic carbon and burn through way more ancient life underneath the Earth than exists on the surface of the planet. So we're really doing something very strange on this planet and running a weird experiment that's never been run before.
Science journalist Peter Brannon, thanks so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This is NPR News.
10 minutes before 9 now. This is Morning Edition on WPR. And coming up just after 9, we'll have an update on the news from NPR and WPR, and then classical music for your Labor Day with Stephanie Elkins. She starts out with a suite by Mark O'Connor called Strings and Threads. Also some Gershwin in the first hour, and the Pygmalion Overture by Jean-Philippe Rameau coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. All that and much more on the way.
Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home, hosting Grief Share, a 13-week support group program for adults grieving the death of someone close. Every Wednesday from August 7th through October 30th, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. To register, call Ann at 262-658-4101.
In addition, you get all the political coverage you need to stay on top, regardless of who comes out on top. Cut through the noise and get to the point with Morning Edition from NPR News.
In sports, the Brewers beat Chicago 4-0 for their second straight shutout against the Cubs. Milwaukee took 2 of 3 in the weekend series to pull within 3 games of Chicago for the second NL wild card. The Brewers next play a pair of games against the Astros today and tomorrow. Partly sunny skies today, breezy in the north, and thunderstorms are likely in the evening hours, highs from the upper 70s to the low 80s. Windy and cloudy on Tuesday with rain and thunderstorms likely. Some of the storms could be severe with strong winds and heavy rain and highs from the mid-70s to mid-80s.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. A lot of the world's illicit drug trade originates in Colombia. The country is a major producer of cocaine, heroin, and marijuana. A new generation of entrepreneurs there is trying to put a positive spin on at least one Colombian narcotic. Reporter John Otis has the story.
Julian Wilches greets his employees at a marijuana production site near the farm town of Pesca in central Colombia. Wilches is co-founder of Clever Leaves, one of the world's largest medical marijuana companies. Inside a series of greenhouses, Clever Leaves is growing 37 acres of marijuana. In this one, workers are watering marijuana seedlings. Within a few months, the plants will be 4 or 5 feet tall and ready for harvest. This involves clipping away the stems and branches while preserving the flowers, which are rich in chemical compounds called cannabinoids.
So this is the drying area.
Drying area. So right here, cutting, drying, and after that, we're going to milling.
The flowers are then dried and ground. The powder is turned into oils, extracts, and crystals at a Clever Leaves laboratory. This year, the company began exporting its cannabis products to Canada and the UK. Many countries are starting to legalize medical marijuana, but Colombia has a leg up on most of them because it did so 3 years ago. The industry has its own lobbying group, the Colombian Cannabis Association. Its president is Rodrigo Arcila.
Hay disponibilidad de tierras.
He points out that Colombia offers cheap farmland, relatively low wages, and skilled labor, like these farm workers who are pruning marijuana bushes. Then there's the climate. Colombia sits near the equator, meaning 12 hours of daily sunlight year-round. By contrast, countries with seasonal variations require expensive artificial lights to grow marijuana. Colombia's advantages have prompted more than 24 medical marijuana companies to open their doors here. Among them is Chiron, which produces everything from pain relievers for cancer patients to dog treats that act as calming agents. Alvaro Torres is Chiron's CEO.
It's nice to be able to switch that conversation from Colombia being the drug cartel. And now I go to the United States and people are talking about, wow, you're building a great company, cannabis in Colombia. And that's amazing.
Wilches of Clever Leaves agrees. He also likes the idea of turning the traditional pharmaceutical power structure on its head.
Pharmaceuticals always come from the global north to South America, to Africa, to Asia.
This is something that is changing that model. This is from Colombia to the world.
In the meantime, Clever Leaves has created nearly 500 jobs. Among the workers is Patti Santiago, a mother of two from northern Colombia. After her husband was threatened by neighborhood dope dealers, they fled here. Even though it's legal, Santiago says she initially felt a bit scared working on a marijuana plantation, but she's gotten used to it. She says the new industry proves Colombian drugs don't have to be linked to drug traffickers. Now she says they can be used to treat people. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Pesca, Colombia.
Former movie mogul Harvey Weinstein is awaiting trial on charges of sexual assault. Meanwhile, the streaming service Hulu is releasing a documentary featuring testimony from women who say he harassed or raped them. The film is called Untouchable, The Rise and Fall of Harvey Weinstein, and it's out today. A note that this review has graphic content. Here's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans.
It may seem as if there's not a lot left to learn about the case that ignited the current Me Too movement. The allegations of sexual assault and harassment that toppled Harvey Weinstein were detailed back in 2017 by Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reports in The New York Times and The New Yorker. That touched off a wave of reporting that continues to this day. Still, Hulu's Untouchable proves if you think you know everything about Weinstein's case, you better think again.
He really thinks he's telling the truth when he says he hasn't had unconsensual sex. If I get what I want, it was consensual. I think he believes that.
That's Hope Demaree, a woman who worked for Weinstein in the 1970s when he was one of the biggest concert promoters in Buffalo, New York. Demaree says Weinstein forced her into sex when the two went on a business trip to New York City. 40 years later, you can still hear and see her emotions as she struggles to talk about it.
I mean, it's the collateral damage that, you know, what it does to relationships with friends, people you love. And they don't know why.
Like previous documentaries, Surviving R. Kelly and Leaving Neverland, Untouchable reveals the power in seeing people who say they've been assaulted giving direct personal testimony. Untouchable also features the words of those who worked for Weinstein at the film company he ran with his brother Bob, Miramax. The success of films like The Crying Game and Sex, Lies, and Videotape made Weinstein a Hollywood power broker. But a montage of comments from former employees also revealed an abusive management style.
I've ducked from a couple of ashtrays being thrown at me, one of them that probably weighed 5 pounds made out of marble.
If you were in his way, it didn't matter. He was, an equal opportunity abuser.
Miramax broke a ton of people. Harvey broke a ton of people.
It's just how it was. You either dealt with it or you left.
One former employee, Zelda Perkins, described fighting off his advances while working for Miramax in London.
As an assistant, you had to go and get him up in the morning, which meant there'd usually be a tussle at the bedside. He showered. He expected you to go be around when he was naked. He very quickly tried to normalize the situation and just told me I had to get with it and not be such a prissy, and that he didn't have time to worry about my delicate feelings. And, at 23 in your first job, you believe what they tell you.
Weinstein, for his part, has denied any allegations of non-consensual sex and pleaded not guilty in court. But the film details many accusations against him, with several women describing how the producer would threaten to hurt their careers if they didn't give him a massage or have sex. Some describe being so frightened they froze up, unable to fight Weinstein off, as actress Paz de la Huerta describes.
When you read about rape, you read, okay, well, the girl says, screams no, and she kicks and screams, but that's not exactly right. The way in which he overpowered me left me no way out.
Director Ursula McFarlane has created a film that covers a lot, from Weinstein's rise and fall to the ways Hollywood may have enabled his alleged abuses. Most of all, it argues that exposing the abusive behavior of powerful men is the story of our times, ranging beyond any one example to touch every corner of society. I'm Eric Deggans.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Melissa Ingalls. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on WPR. To follow news throughout the day, visit WPR.org. There you can check out statewide reports from WPR's award-winning news team and national and global headlines from NPR.
Support for WPR comes from the Wet Whistle Wine Festival, Friday and Saturday, September 13th and 14th in Algoma. Wine tasting, hearty foods, and a Saturday grape stomp. More is at visitalgomawi.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Powerful Tools for Caregivers is a free 6-week educational series designed to give you the tools to take care of yourself while caring for a loved one. Classes run on Thursdays at Festival Foods in Kenosha. Call 605-6646.
You're listening to WGTD.